Chapter 6. Candy, unless we take the trouble to explain? Well, the little dignified answer of the worthy dealer in bergamot, never mind her name, Captain, threw the gallant captain quite aback, and though he sat for a quarter of an hour longer, and was exceedingly kind, and though he threw out some skillful hints, yet the perfumer was quite unconquerable, or, rather, he was too frightened to tell. The poor fat timid easy good-natured gentleman was always the prey of rogues, panting and floundering in one rascal's snare another's. He had the dissimulation too, which timid men have, and felt the presence of a victimizer as a hare does of a greyhound. Now he would be quite still, now he would double, and now he would run, and then came the end. He knew, by his sure instinct of fear, that the captain had, in asking these questions, a scheme against him, and so he was cautious, and trembled, and doubted. And oh, how he thanked his stars, when Lady Grogmore's chariot drove up, with the Mrs. Grogmore, who wanted their hair dressed, and were going to a breakfast at 3 o'clock. "I'll look in again, Tiny," said the captain, on hearing the summons. "Do, Captain," said the other, "colon thank you," and went into the lady's studio with a heavy heart. "Get out of the way, you infernal villain," roared the captain, with many oaths, to Lady Grogmore's large footman, with ruby-colored tights, who was standing inhaling the 10,000 perfumes of the shop, and the latter, moving away in great terror, the gallant agent passed out, quite heedless of the grin of Mr. Mazras. Walker was in a fury at his want of success, and walked down Bond Street in a fury. "We'll know where the girl lives," swore he. "I'll spend a £5 note, by Jove, rather than not know where she lives." "That you would, I know you would," said a little grave low voice, all of a sudden, by his side. "Pooh! What's money to you?" Walker looked down. It was Tom Dale. Who in London did not know little Tom Dale? He had cheeks like an apple, and his hair curled every morning, and a little blue stock, and always two new magazines under his arm, and an umbrella and a little brown frock coat, and big square-toed shoes with which he went papping down the street. He was everywhere at once. Everybody met him every day, and he knew everything that everybody ever did, though nobody ever knew what he did. He was, they say, 100 years old, and had never dined at his own charge once in those 100 years. He looked like a figure out of a waxwork, with glassy, clear, meaningless eyes. He always spoke with a grin. He knew what you had for dinner the day before he met you, and what everybody had had for dinner for a century back almost. He was the receptacle of all the scandal of all the world, from Bond Street to Bread Street. He knew all the authors, all the actors, all the notorieties of the town, and the private histories of each. That is, he never knew anything really, but supplied deficiencies of truth and memory with ready-coined, never-failing lies. He was the most benevolent man in the universe, and never saw you without telling you everything most cruel of your neighbor, and when he left you, he went to do the same kind turn by yourself. "Pooh! What's money to you, my dear boy?" said little Tom Dale, who had just come out of Ebers, where he had been filching an opera ticket. "Who make it in bushels in the city, you know you do in thousands. I saw you go into Eglantons. Fine business that. Finest in London. 5 shilling cakes of soap, my dear boy. I can't wash with such. Thousands a year, that man has made, hasn't he? Upon my word, Tom, I don't know," says the captain. "You not know? Don't tell me. You know everything, you agents. You know he makes 5,000 a year, and might make 10, but you know why he don't. Indeed I don't. Nonsense. Don't humbug a poor old fellow like me. Jews Amos 50%. Eh? Why can't he get his money from a good Christian?" "I have heard something of that sort," said Walker, laughing. "Hi, by Jove, Tom, you know everything. You know everything, my dear boy. You know what a rascally trick that opera creature served him, poor fellow. Cashmere Shawl Store and Mortimer's Star and Garter. Apostrophe apostrophe much better dine quiet off pea soup and sprats, eh? His betters have, as you know very well. Pea soup and sprats. What? Have you heard of that already? Who bailed Lord Billingsgate? Hey, you rogue. And here Tom gave a knowing and almost demoniacal grin. Oh, wouldn't go to the finish? Who had the piece of plate presented to him filled with sovereigns? And you deserved it, my dear boy, you deserved it. They said it was only halfpence, but I know better. And here Tom went off in a cough. I say, Tom, cried Walker, inspired with a sudden thought, you, who know everything, and are a theatrical man, did you ever know a Miss Delancey, an actress? At Sadler's Wells in 16? Of course I did. Real name was Butch. Lord Slapper admired her very much, my dear boy. She married a man by the name of Crump, his lordship's black footman, and brought him £5,000. And they keep the Bootjack public house in Bunker's Buildings, and they've got 14 children. Is one of them handsome, eh, you sly rogue, and is it that which you will give £5 to know? God bless you, my dear, dear boy. Jones, my dear friend, how are you? And now, seizing on Jones, Tom Dale left Mr. Walker alone, and proceeded to pour into Mr. Jones' ear an account of the individual whom he had just quitted, how he was the best fellow in the world, and Jones knew it, how he was in a fine way of making his fortune, how he had been in the fleet many times, and how he was at this moment employed in looking out for a young lady, of whom a certain great marquess, whom Jones knew very well, too, had expressed an admiration. But for these observations, which he did not hear, Captain Walker, it may be pronounced, did not care. His eyes brightened up, he marched quickly and gaily away, and turning into his own chambers opposite Eglanton's shop, saluted that establishment with a grin of triumph. Who wouldn't tell me her name, wouldn't you? Said Mr. Walker. L, the luck's with me now, and here goes. 2 days after, as Mr. Eglanton, with white gloves and a case of eau de cologne as a present in his pocket, arrived at the Bootjack Hotel, Little Bunker's Buildings, Berkeley Square, for it must out that was the place in which Mr. Crump's inn was situated, he paused for a moment at the threshold of the little house of entertainment, and listened, with beating heart, to the sound of delicious music that a well-known voice was uttering within. The moon was playing in silvery brightness down the gutter of the humble street. A helper, rubbing down one of Lady Smigsmack's carriage horses, even paused in his whistle to listen to the strain. Mr. Tressel's man, who had been professionally occupied, ceased his tap-tap upon the coffin which he was getting in readiness. The greengrocer, there is always a greengrocer in those narrow streets, and he goes out in white Berlin gloves as a supernumerary footman, was standing charmed at his little green gate. The cobbler, there is always a cobbler too, was drunk, as usual, of evenings, but, with unusual subordination, never sang except when the refrain of the ditty arrived, when he hiccuped it forth with tipsy loyalty. And Eglanton leaned against the checkers painted on the door side under the name of Crump, and looked at the red illumined curtain of the bar, and the vast well-known shadow of Mrs. Crump's turban within. Now and again the shadow of that worthy matron's hand would be seen to grasp the shadow of a bottle, then the shadow of a cup would rise towards the turban, and still the strain proceeded. Eglanton, I say, took out his yellow bandana, and brushed the beady drops from his brow, and laid the contents of his white kids on his heart, and sighed with ecstatic sympathy. The song began, Ome to the greenwood tree, one, come where the dark woods be, dearest, oh come with me. Let us rove, oh my love, oh my love, oh my why love. Drunken cobbler without, oh my why love. Beast, says Eglanton. Ome, tis the moonlight hour, dew is on leaf and flower, come to the linden bower, let us rove, oh my love, oh my love. Let us rove, oh, ove, lurlurliety, yes, we'll rove, lurlurliety, through the grove, oh, ove, lurlurliety, lurlurliety, cobbler, as usual, let us row off, etc., you hear? Says another individual, coming clinking up the street, in a military cut dress coat, the buttons whereof shone very bright in the moonlight. Oh, you here, Eglanton? You're always here. Hush, we'll see, said Mr. Eglanton to his rival the tailor, for he was the individual in question, and we'll see, accordingly, put his back against the opposite doorpost and checkers, so that with poor Eglanton's bulk, nothing much thicker than a sheet of paper could pass out or in. And thus these two amorous caryatides kept guard as the song continued. Arc is the wood, and wide, dangers, they say, betide. But, at my Albert's side, naught, I fear, oh my love, welcome the greenwood tree, welcome the forest tree, dearest, with thee, naught I fear, oh my why love. Eglanton's fine eyes were filled with tears as Morgina passionately uttered the above beautiful words. Little Woolsey's eyes glistened, as he clenched his fist with an oath, and said, show me any singing that can beat that. Cobbler, shut your mouth, or I'll break your head. But the cobbler, regardless of the threat, continued to perform the lullerliety with great accuracy, and when that was ended, both on his part and Morgina's, a rapturous knocking of glasses was heard in the little bar, then a great clapping of hands, and finally somebody shouted Brava! Brava! At that word Eglanton turned deadly pale, then gave a start, then a rush forward, which pinned, or rather cushioned, the tailor against the wall, then twisting himself abruptly round, he sprang to the door of the bar, and bounced into that apartment. How are you, my nosegay? Exclaimed the same voice which had shouted, Rava. It was that of Captain Walker. At 10 o'clock the next morning, a gentleman, with the king's button on his military coat, walked abruptly into Mr. Eglanton's shop, and, turning on Mr. Mazras, said, tell your master I want to see him. He's in his studio, said Mr. Mazras. Well then, fellow, go and fetch him. And Mazras, thinking it must be the Lord Chamberlain, or Dr. Pretorius at least, walked into the studio, where the perfumer was seated in a very glossy old silk dressing gown, his fair hair hanging over his white face, his double chin over his flaccid whitey brown shirt collar, his pea-green slippers on the hob, and on the fire the pot of chocolate which was simmering for his breakfast. A lazier fellow than poor Glanton it would be hard to find. Whereas, on the contrary, Woolsey was always up and brushed, spick and span, at 7 o'clock, and had gone through his books, and given out the work for the journeyman, and eaten a hearty breakfast of rashers of bacon, before Glanton had put the usual pound of grease to his hair. His fingers were always as damp and shiny as if he had them in a pomatum pot, and arranged his figure for the day. Here's a gent wants you in the shop, says Mr. Mazras, leaving the door of communication wide open. Say I'm in bed, Mr. Mazras. I'm out of spirits, and really can see nobody. It's someone from Vincer, I think. He's got the royal button, says Mazras. It's me Woolsey, shouted the little man from the shop. Mr. Eglanton at this jumped up, made a rush to the door leading to his private apartment, and disappeared in a twinkling. But it must not be imagined that he fled in order to avoid Mr. Woolsey. He only went away for 1 minute, just to put on his belt, for he was ashamed to be seen without it by his rival. This being assumed, and his toilet somewhat arranged, Mr. Woolsey was admitted into his private room. And Mazras would have heard every word of the conversation between those two gentlemen, had not Woolsey, opening the door, suddenly pounced on the assistant, taken him by the collar, and told him to disappear altogether into the shop. Which Mazras did, vowing he would have his revenge. The subject on which Woolsey had come to treat was an important one. Mr. Eglanton, says he, there's no use disguising from one another that we are both of us in love with Miss Morgina, and that our chances up to this time have been pretty equal. But that captain whom you introduced, like an ass as you were an ass, Mr. Woolsey, I'd have you to know, sir, that I'm no more a ass than you are, sir. And as for introducing the captain, I did no such thing. Well, he's got a poaching into our preserve somehow. He's evidently sweet upon the young woman, and is a more fashionable chap than either of us two. We must get him out of the house, sir, we must circumvent him. And then, Mr. Eglanton, will be time enough for you and me to try which is the best man. He the best man? Thought Eglanton, the little bald unsightly tailor creature. A man with no more soul than his smoothing iron. The perfumer, as may be imagined, did not utter this sentiment aloud, but expressed himself quite willing to enter into any amicable arrangement by which the new candidate for Miss Crump's favor must be thrown over. It was accordingly agreed between the two gentlemen that they should coalesce against the common enemy, that they should, by reciting many perfectly well-founded stories in the captain's disfavor, influence the minds of Miss Crump's parents, and of herself, if possible, against this wolf in sheep's clothing, and that, when they were once fairly rid of him, each should be at liberty, as before, to prefer his own claim. I have thought of a subject, said the little tailor, turning very red, and hemming and hawing a great deal. Of thought, I say, of a pint, which may be resorted to with advantage at the present. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.